So we are into the hardware section. And last time we talked about GPUs as part of the PC. And you know what, with an hour and 15 minute lecture, you know what, I hope what I did was to help you to start thinking about bandwidth, you know, especially the CPU and GPU transfer in a more concrete way. You know, you can argue that you don't necessarily need that lecture in order to remember that there is a 4 gigabyte per second uplink and then 4 gigabyte second downlink to transfer bandwidth between the CPU and the GPU. But I think it's beneficial for you to get a little bit broader knowledge and a little bit deeper understanding of these things. You know, these things are all very concrete. Okay, they don't have to be mystery. Okay, they don't really have to be, you know, totally memorization. Especially when you start to think about future. You know, the future of PCI Express. You know, kind of things. You know, knowing some of the background will allow you to grow in the future. Allow you to, you know, understand better how these, you know, next generation GPU cards will do. And you know, when AMD announced some mechanism for them to do Terenza and so on, it will make more sense to you. And you know what, so hopefully these lectures are, you know, beneficial in that sense. So today we're going to circle back a little bit, okay, and talk about the threading hardware. And again, you know what, there are things that will be, you know, that you have seen bits and pieces in, you know, when I talk about threading in the first few lectures. But what I'd like to do is to take you back into the hardware perspective a little bit more so that you will be able to think about performance in a more comprehensive way. And also to make sure that some of these things are no longer just pure memorization. And hopefully these things will begin to really make sense and become your second nature. Unfortunately, parallel programming today is still very much tied to the hardware details. Okay, whether you're programming Intel machines, whether you're programming AMD machines, whether you're programming NVIDIA machines, all these things are still very much, the programming interface still has to be tied very much to the hardware details when it comes to performance. So we're going to begin to have you to optimize your program for performance. And one of the things that we really need to do is to make sure that you have a pretty, pretty good and straightforward understanding of the hardware in a way that it will be very, very easy for you to translate between, your program structure and how it's going to actually operate and how it's going to act on the hardware. And a lot of the hardware details are not necessarily in the programming model that was spanned across multiple generations. These things can change from the first generation G80 series to the second generation G280 series. A lot of things already changed. So I actually struggled a little bit. You know what, I was thinking about maybe, updating this lecture to cover 280. But then I started to realize that some of the initial performance work that you're going to do in this class, this semester, are still going to be on the G80. So a better strategy, at least for this semester, is to make sure that we give a G80 a good coverage. And then later on, right before we transition into G280 for some of your final projects, I would, John and I will put together a lecture update, just kind of the differences between G80 and G280. And hopefully that will be a very quick half a lecture, but bring you up to speed before you start to port your program into G280. So, we talk about threading, and you're going to see some familiar hardware, some familiar slides. And so what I would like to do is to begin to take you kind of with me a little bit and, make this lecture a little bit more interactive and make sure that you're thinking with me, because I want to make sure that, you are you start to get into active mode, and you know, start to articulate about these hardware things, you know, as you program. So you know what, just go back to this, you know, the fundamental model. We have seen this slide before. You know what, looking back, it should be very clear to you what single program multiple data SPMD means.
Yes,
Maddie.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's dim the light a little bit. Wait. I think
you
I
have it.
I have it, right? Lightning. How about better? Or the other one? Oops. How about this? Better?
No.
How about this?
Yes.
Even better. How about this?
Yes.
Okay. Good compromise? Okay. So, you know what? It should be very clear what we mean by CUDA integrated CPU and GPU application C program, right? You know, we have gone through the host code, we have gone through the kernels, right? So you know what, it should be very clear that CUDA is not just a programming model for programming GPUs alone. It's really a programming model for programming combined CPU and GPU execution, right? It should be very clear at this point. And you know what? So when we invoke a CUDA kernel, the GPU, you know what? The CPU code will actually do a kernel invocation, and it will give you as the first parameter the configuration of the grid, right? So the grid organization in terms of what? Blocks. Right, and then the second one is the block organization in terms of threads, and you can have straightforward one-dimensional organization in which you can just give the size of the grid in terms of blocks and the size of the blocks in terms of threads, but you can also have multiple dimensions, right? This is actually part of what we're going to get into in more detail. You can have up to two dimensions in your grid organization. So you can have a two-dimensional block organization into a grid, and you can have an up to three-dimension organization from thread into blocks. So you know what? So we invoke the kernels, and then we go down and invoke another kernel. And by this time, it should be also very clear to you, the execution of a kernel, you know, with that invocation, will launch a lot of threads, right? And all those threads are going to be based on the same kernel function code. So essentially, they're all executing out of the same piece of code, okay? And this actually makes the GPU threading a little bit different from the CPU multi-threading. If you look at the CPU multi-threading today, a lot of the CPU multi-threading actually have to do with executing different programs at the same time, very different programs. So, you know, if you look at the laptop today, you will have Microsoft Word running in concurrent with, something like a voice recording, something like a web browser. So all these, different applications are actually simultaneously executing on the CPU, okay? And that's the CPU multi-threading. But in this particular CUDA multi-threading model, whenever you're running threads in parallel, as of today, these threads are all going to be executing out of that same kernel function. That's why it's single program multiple data. Okay? And they will come back very conveniently when we talk about the hardware. So slide three is a little bit of a review as well. So you know what, when we look at the kernel, we will execute the kernel as a grid of thread blocks, right? So all the threads share global memory space. This is also something very important for you to become to have it as a second nature. You know what? All these threats, or all these threat blocks, right? When they execute, they can all access that global memory. Which part of global memory each one access depends on the block ID and thread ID, right? So by this time, you should have already exercised all these calculations, and it should be pretty clear. And the thread block is a batch of threads that can cooperate with each other. So within that thread block, within up to that 512 threads that you organize into a block, you can synchronize the execution by calling sync threads. Good. And you can, they can efficiently share data through a low latency shared memory, right? And two threads from different blocks, however, cannot cooperate, okay? So what that means is that these threads from different blocks can execute in any order. It doesn't, whatever they do does not concern each other, the other one, right? And that, is the primary design choice made in order to, to support scaling, right? Scaling of, transparent scaling of generations. So, this actually also goes back to, one of the most common complaints about CUDA, that is, there's no global barrier synchronization, okay? For those of you who work on time step functions, okay? If you do a simulation of a system, let's say finite difference time domain analysis, then you will have a time step where you move the system forward, and in every time step, in general, you need to have a barrier synchronization and make sure right everyone in the system has moved up to the next level before you can move the system clock, and this is typically done by ending the kernel, okay, right before the time step, and then relaunching the next kernel for the for the time step. So, a lot of that is rooted in this particular constraint. Okay, now the fourth slide is also review here. The programmer declares the thread block. And the block size can be from anywhere from 1 to 512 concurrent threads. And by this time, it should also be very clear to you, declaring a thread block of one thread is not the best idea, right? It's probably, pretty clear to everyone that, having only one thread per block is not going to be a very bright thing to do. However, I have seen that happen, okay? I've seen it happen in situations where, there's actually a huge amount of divergence, meaning, the threads are truly doing very different things. And in that case, if you declared multiple threads into the same block, they will be lumped into the warps, as we will talk about later. And then, they will begin to have all kinds of divergence, which will be the topic of the lecture either Wednesday or Thursday. So unless these threads have extremely different if then else behavior and so on through the kernels, people tend to declare quite a few threads, okay, into these thread blocks. And the blocks can be of shape of 1D, 2D, and 3D. And most of the examples that we use will be of either 1D or 2D, but you should be able to program with 3D dimensions by this point. And the block dimensions are in terms of threads. So again, all the threads in a block execute the same thread program, which is the kernel. And then thread shared data is synchronized while doing their share of work, and they use their thread ID and block ID, to select the shared data from the global memory. Okay. And one of the the favorite way of expressing this is by John Nichols, and he gave this talk at Hot Chip, and I stole his picture. You can imagine that there is a single program, a threat program, and then you have all these threats coming out of that program, right? But they're really executing essentially the same code. So now, some terminologies, okay? And this is where you start to kind of buckle up a little bit, and so let's talk about some terminologies. Terminologies are always annoying to me, by the way. I never like terminologies. Sometimes I feel that people invent too many terminologies and just confuse people, right? But in this particular one, the terminologies are actually convenient when you start to look into some of the the literature and some of the web postings and so on. So it is unfortunately necessary for me to at least give you some terminologies. And I believe NVIDIA is actually trying to simplify the terminology as they go, they move forward. So hopefully some of these things will gradually die down, because that actually is the way it should be. So when you buy a GPU chip, that chip will essentially consist of streaming processor array. Okay, so that's the top picture here. So that's the sort of the top level organization of that chip. The chip essentially contains an array of processors called, this array is called streaming processor array. And this is very much a historical thing. I'm actually going to have David Kirk to give a historic lecture, about the GPU hardware, and especially from the graphics point of view, and you will start to see a lot, some of these terminologies will make even more sense, after David talked about that history. But at this point, we decided to to kind of push ahead on some of these concepts without the history, so that you can start to think about performance tuning and so on better. But then we will come back and do a retroactive kind of treatment of GPU's history. So hopefully by that time everything will come together. So you have this array of streaming processor array, and essentially these things are designed for you to have a huge amount of data coming into the processor. And you generate a huge amount of data out of the processor. And these things are designed to sustain very high rate of data streaming through, and then you do some value add computation on it, and then put it in back into the memory. So in the G80 design that you're going to use, there will be 8 of these. Each streaming processor array will have 8 of those building blocks. And these building blocks are called TPC, Texture Processor Cluster. This fully exposes the graphics lineage of this whole design. Texture is a graphics term. And so that reveals the fact that the hardware was really designed to paint. It is designed to take a piece of texture. What is a texture? The easiest way to think about it is the texture of your clothes. Let's say you have this a very nice plaid shirt here, right? And a small piece of that plaid pattern will be the texture, And you can take this texture and paint it on the whole shirt, right? And that's how graphics works. So fundamentally, these processors are designed to take a piece of information and then kind of essentially paint it, on a large amount of space, and that's what these processors are doing. So each TPC or texture processor cluster consists of 2 streaming multiprocessors in the current design. It may well have more or less in the future, So it currently has 2 of these streaming multiprocessors, and they share a texture memory, And this texture memory has not been taught, okay, in this class. And you know what, for those of you who are interested in using texture memory, you're more than welcome to look at the NVIDIA documentation, and they have the API for you to use the texture memory. And I think the texture memory API is finally stabilizing a little bit. So you know what, you might be able to start to write code and expect the you know, the texture usage to work correct as you expect when they go from one SDK release to the next SDK release. So you know what, it seems to be stabilizing at this point. And so the streaming multiprocessors are really the workhorse, okay, of the you know, for executing the CUDA threads. And so you know, a lot of the explanations that we're going to make in the you know, about you know, threading hardware actually come from the streaming multiprocessor internals. Okay, so the fundamental scaling model for this design is to add more and more and more of the texture processor cluster into the designs. So for G80, there were, you know, 8 of these TPCs, okay, texture processing processor clusters. And you know what, for G280, you know, they increased it to, I think they increased to not 16, right? Is that 15?
Say that again.
The TPC. I think it's 15. Well, jump process.
Yeah, let me think. Before it was 8, and now it's
30. It's not quite 32, it's 30.
I want to say it's 10, and there are 3 SMs per TPC in the new generation.
So
I'm not certain about that, though.
So, you know what? We'll do the G280 presentation. So that when you scale, you will have more TPCs and possibly more SMs, okay, in each TPC. But usually you can expect the SMs to kind of look the same with some minor improvement, okay, from generation to the generation. Well, one example is, you know, from G80 to G280, there are more registers available for your automatic variables, okay? So, you know, when we blow up the streaming multiprocessor, or SM, you can, you know, the hardware will have, you know, instruction cache, data cache, and instruction fetch, dispatch, shared memory, and then you will have 8 of these, you know, streaming processors, or SPs. And then you have super function units, 2 of those super function units. And you know what, we're going to actually go through some of these things. And the level 1 data cache is actually a little bit confusing, okay? So you know, it has to do with constants and so on. So we're going to actually cover some of these things in the next couple lectures. And so from this point on, you're going to hear the term streaming multiprocessor, or SM, quite often, okay? So before I leave this slide, I want you to, you know, to know that the SM is really the fundamental building block, okay, of the hardware, okay? Each SM consists of, you know, 8 of these streaming processors, and that number may increase or decrease, but you know what, it seemed to stabilizing about 8, but you know, these things can, you know, really change, especially more than 1 generation from now. So every time we talk about SM, it's one of these, okay? So the slide 6 is really just a summary, okay? And this summary is actually quite useful. I'm not gonna talk through this again, okay? I already talked through this. But this is a quick reference for you, okay? Every time things get confusing, you know, come back, you know, look at the summary, you know, it should clear it up for you. So let's go into the SM, or streaming multiprocessor, okay? And so, you know, one thing that should stand out is that there's 8 of these streaming processors, And what that means is that each streaming processor, you know what, go back up a little bit. Within the SAM, you know, you can actually do multi-threaded instruction dispatch. And you can have, you know what, between 1 and, it's not 512, it's 768 threads active. And the sheer instruction fetch, the instruction is actually fetch is shared between 32 threads. So in this hardware, you have an instruction storage. Okay, the instruction is stored in the instruction cache. And then every time you go to that cache and fetch one instruction, you're going to be using that instruction for 32 threads. Okay, and what that means is that it doesn't matter whether one or two or multiple of those threads don't want that instruction. Okay, some of you asked that question. So, you know what, remember these are 32 threads and each one will have their own program counter. Okay, so they will be executing, you know what, in an independent way, right? So, you know what, if you have an if then else statement in the kernel, it may well be that, you know, some of the paths are following the then, some of the paths are following the else, right? So at any point in time, if you give one instruction to all the 32 threads, some of them will say, yeah, you know, that's the instruction I want. And some of them will say, nah, that's not what I want. I'm executing somewhere else, right? So the hardware doesn't care. Okay, the hardware just go and get that instruction and shove it down the throat of all these threads. So some of the threads will gladly swallow it and digest it. Some of them will vomit. Okay, so that's, it's up to the threads to reject these things. Okay, and you know what? We'll come actually go deeper into this very soon. And this, you know what, essentially the multi-threaded instruction dispatch are designed to cover the latency of global memory loads. And in the situation where you decide to use texture, there is a significant latency accessing texture memory, okay? It's not a very small number of cycles. It's actually quite a few cycles. And that also can be tolerated with multi-threaded instruction dispatch. Each SAM can execute about 20 plus gigaflops, and it has 16 kilobytes of sheer memory, you know, that you have used for matrix multiplication, the tie-out version, right? And you know what? So it actually has logic to perform the texture and global memory accesses. So let's go back to the global hardware picture, and start with the graphics view of this wallet.
I have and so the term local memory in a few places since the beginning of the course.
Yes.
But I never saw a box called local memory.
Yes. Okay. Local. You're probably talking about the local memory in the architecture. Okay. So local, remember we have global memory, mm-hmm. We have local memory, and you know these are memory spaces. Yes. So local memory is actually mapped into global, the same DRAM as global memory. And the only thing is local memory is allocated on a per thread basis. So every thread will have its own local memory space. So whenever a variable is declared in a kernel into local memory, mm-hmm. multiple, you know what, it will be replicated for every thread. Okay, so that's the only thing. So you can achieve the same effect of, you know what, getting local memory by declaring a variable as a automatic variable. And if you have too many of those, some of them will become spill, and they will become local memory variables.
Okay. And in the hardware boxes, I never saw a box where the threads are controlled, you know, control unit of the thread.
Yes. So they're coming. Yes, they're coming. Good. So the question is, you know, how come I never seen a, you know, a bot doing called threat control? And so they're coming. Okay. So you know what? So let's start with the graphics mode, and I alluded to this at the beginning of the semester. And but for those of you who are primarily, you know, not in the computer architecture field, you know what? It's probably worth talking about again, just to make sure that, you know what, it really sinked in. So in the graphics mode, the, you know what, we're showing the eight what? TP, you know, the eight TPCs, right? And all the eight PDCs form the what? The SPA, right? So the middle part shows all the collective eight TPCs that form the SPA. And so if you look into each TPC, you will see two streaming multiprocessors depicted as collection of eight little processing units. And then you have, you know, a texture fetch mechanism, an L1. And L1, you know what, is actually the texture, you know, the main mechanism to store the texture in this, you know, in this graphics processor. And then you have, you know what, a memory interface into the frame buffer. And frame buffer is a historical term in the sense that the graphics processors are going to generate pictures, right? So these pictures are organized into frames that they display on the screen. So the DRAM traditionally have been used as buffers to hold those pictures. And then you can, you know, flip them onto the screen for display, right? So that's why it's called frame buffer, and they're all DRAMs. And another terminology that you often use is GDDR, graphics dynamic, you know, DRAM. Okay. So GDDR, yes. So you know what, the kind of memory that are used for these frame buffers tend to be very, very fast. Okay? Because graphics usually require fast memory so that you can dump a lot of information into the memory very quickly, and also the display can pick the information out of the memory very quickly into the displays. However, these memory tend to be less reliable, because whenever you have some glitch, okay, let's say if the memory actually, you know, have some little glitch and the information in the memory gets lost, and what happens is that, you know, the picture that you're going to display may have a little bit of a, you know, a weird dot or something on that picture. But most human eyes don't really see that, right? So, you know, you may well think that your screen is a little dirty or something. So, you know what, most people don't care if the information stored in these, you know, frame buffers are solid and never get corrupted in any way. So that's why these memories are not protected by some of the, you know, mechanism that PC box, you know, PC memory or mainframe memory use for error correction or error detection. And this is one of the frequently asked questions that if you go to a seminar, people will ask, when is the, you know, the GPU memory going to have error correction? Okay. And that's, you know, that's from this historical perspective. The answer is, if you look at Tesla line, the Tesla boxes that we receive from NVIDIA for the next generation AC cluster, the memory actually come with error correction code these days. Okay. And it's just that, you know, as soon as they start to do computing, then they started to, you know, to have to be more careful about how they handle information and keep the integrity of the information. Yes?
What is the battery and blue button next to the L2?
Okay. So, ask that question again.
The battery of blue boxes next to the L2 caches.
This thing, right?
Yeah.
That's the memory interface. Okay. Because, you know what, you have these memory channels that, you know what, that are, you know what, that you need to have the various logic in order to, you know, to interface to the DRAM. And DRAM is actually a very tricky business. You know what? It transfers a huge amount of information to you, so you need to be able to, you know, to get the right section of the information and you know, you need to pick out the device that you want and so on. So there, you know, some fairly, you know, complicated logic. Now, there's so the threading model in graphics is, you know, what is fundamentally a what we call the API based approach, meaning that you know, the game programs tend to make function calls and say, draw all these triangles for me, okay, or to say, you know, rotate or do a, you know, a coordinate transformation on these triangles for me, right, so that I can switch to a different view. Or you say, you know, paint this kind of texture on all those triangles for me, right? So, you know what, paint some kind of, you know what, light or something, right? All these are, you know, kind of function calls that the game developers make. And the GPUs make money by implementing a lot of these function calls directly in hardware so that they can do things very fast. And this is the differentiation between low-cost graphics hardware and you know, expensive graphics hardware. Low-cost hardware that come with, you know, with some of these, you know, PCs usually implement a lot of these things in software. But the graphics processors such as G80 implement a lot of these function calls directly in hardware. And how? The host will actually send that function call, okay, into the hardware through the driver. Okay, so for those of you who are familiar with this terminology, right? The driver is a piece of software that the manufacturer, you know, provide an interface with your Windows, with your Linux, so that the applications can actually, you know what, operate the devices by calling operating system called the driver. Now, the input assembler receives these function calls, drawing triangles, all that stuff, okay? And then it will determine whether it's a vertex thread, it's a vertex operation, meaning, you know, drawing some of these dots and then, you know, triangles and so on, or it could be a geometry, you know, operation, which means that, you know, you may be able to scale, okay, you may be able to turn, rotate, and so on, and you know, that also requires oftentimes sines and cosines, okay. So I'm, you know, beginning to take you into some of the internals, you know, why some of these things, you know, exist. And then you will also have pixel, you know, threads. You know, after you're done with some of these triangle kind of things, you start to draw these things into the screen, into the picture, and the picture consists of all these little dots, right? So for each dot, you're going to determine the color, you're going to determine the intensity, and all that stuff. So the comment will actually be identified as one of those three categories. And then once they get into that category, let's say vertex thread issue, it will actually take that command and generate a large number of threads. For example, it may generate a large number of threads and one will be drawing one triangle each. Okay, so that's where the massive parallelism comes into the to play. And for pixel processing, you will be generating massive number of threads. Each one will be generating one dot on a high definition display, right? Huge amount of parallels, right? So these are the kind of the threads. So that's why these threads are typically based on a small function, okay? A small function, right? That function will be executed by many, many threads. A small function will be drawing a triangle, right? A small function will be rotating a triangle, but then that function is going to be executed by many, many threads, you know, to draw many triangles. So, you know what, those things are dispatched into the SMs. So in order to keep the SM busy, you will have a, you know, mechanism that will, you know, hopefully send millions of these pixel drawing, you know, commands in, you know, the threads. And then, you know, each of them will land into one of these SEMs, right? So each SM will accommodate 700 up to 768 of builds, right? And then you multiply by 16, you get the total number of threads you can have. Now, when NVIDIA did the CUDA implementation, essentially they just changed the top portion of the top part of the control mechanism. So you're no longer sending these graphics commands, but you're sending kernel invocations into the hardware. What do they come with? The kernel invocation come with these threading organizations, right? It says, generate so many blocks, right? And each block generates so many threads. So this thread execution manager will take your kernel, okay, and begin to generate thread blocks. These thread blocks are generated according to the invocation parameter, okay? And then it will essentially start to farm out these thread blocks into the SMs. I don't know exactly how it is done, and they're not going to tell me how it is done, but chances are you will just quickly assign like one thread block to each SM, and then and then you will come back and assign more and more until they're all full, right? And then as soon as one of these SMs complete a thread block, the hardware will probably assign another thread block. So if you have a large number of thread blocks, you should be able to keep all the 16 busy for a long, long time, right? And if you have a large number of thread blocks, you can also do better load balance, meaning that you don't have a situation where everyone else is done, but there's one block running in one of the SMs for a long time after everyone is done, right? And have you had a situation where you say, hey, we need to leave, and then one of your roommates decided that get up late, and then brush teeth for 50 minutes, and then so everyone is waiting for the roommate to leave on a carpool or something, right? So that's low imbalance, okay? And having a large number of blocks allows you to avoid that kind of situation by having each block to do smaller amount of work. So this thread execution manager generates thread grids based on the kernel invocation, and then it farms out all these blocks, okay, into the SMs. So this leads to sort of the thread life cycle in the hardware, okay? So you launch this kernel, and launching the kernel generates a grid, okay? And that grid start to happen on the SDA, and then the thread blocks are serially distributed to all these SMs, and potentially greater than one thread block per SM. In fact, you want to have more than one thread block per SM, because every time you do a barrier synchronization, you will have fewer and fewer and fewer threads running as they approach the barrier synchronization. So you will want to have another block running on the same SM, and hopefully when one hits the barrier, the other one may not hit the barrier, so that you can keep the hardware fully utilized. And each SM launches warps of threads. And so as soon as the block arrives at the SM, they're divided into 32 thread warps, okay? So that's why it's a two-level parallelism. You have parallelism across blocks, and you have parallelism within the block, but across the warps. And these warps are largely going to execute in parallel, except when you have barrier synchronization. That's when these warps start to be tangled up in terms of execution timing with each other. Okay. So the SM will schedule and execute these warps that are ready to run, and as the warps and thread blocks complete, you free the resources, and so the resource allocation is actually done on a block basis, and these blocks complete, the manager sends another block in. Okay. So you know what? The SPA can distribute more of these thread blocks into the hardware. Now, so it should be very clear that SAMs execute blocks. Okay, the blocks, all the threads in a block will be executed by the same SAM. Okay, they stick together in terms of resource usage. They don't go across SAMs. Okay, and also these blocks can be divided into warps. So these warps will actually be the scheduling units. And you can have up to 8 blocks to each SAM, as resource allows. There's enough resource to track the progress and resources that eventually need to be freed when the block completes. And there are enough resources to track the progress of 8 of these. And SAM in G80 can take up to 768 threads. Essentially, there are enough resources to track up to 24 of those warps, and 24 times 32 is 768. So the funny number 768 really comes from the fact that the scheduling hardware can juggle up to 24 of those warps in terms of scheduling, okay? And when you do scheduling, you need to keep track of who's ready to go, who's not ready to go, and who has been executing, who else should come into the picture. So you need to juggle quite a few things. So there's limited amount of hardware, and in this design you can just juggle up to 24 of those. So the 768 gets exposed to the block, to the blocks by as either 200, let's say 256 times 3 blocks, or 128 times 6 blocks, or other combinations. You could have 64 threads per block, but then it's only 8 blocks, right? Because you cannot have more than 8 in SAM. So then you start to underutilize your hardware. We'll come back to this point in the end. So threads run concurrently, but it's not entirely true. Threads don't really, really run concurrently, but threads are capable of running concurrently. And so the SAMs will assign and maintain the thread IDs. That's where all those thread IDX.x, thread IDX.y come from, okay? The SAM maintains all these IDs, and these IDs are initialized by the manager. Okay, so the manager will say, "Hey, this is the block ID." Okay, and then the SAM internally will generate all the thread IDs for the block. Right, and so SAM manages and schedules thread execution. So, is there anything else that I want? SM1, SM2. Okay, that's good. So let's go deeper into the scheduling here. And this is where you're going to have to develop an intuition about the execution timing. So each thread block is divided into 32 thread warps. So keep in mind, this is an implementation decision. Okay, it was the same between G80 and G280, but it's not guaranteed to be the same moving forward. So you could have smaller warps, you could have larger warps as you move forward, and your code should not depend on that size in order to execute correctly. Okay, and I'm going to show you a bad way of doing things that you can depend on it. Okay, and sometimes without thinking about it, you may not even realize your code depends on the warp size. Okay, so we will actually go through some of that bad practices. Warps are scheduling units in SAM. So every time you run anything, 32 gets moved in, okay? And that's kind of the granularity or the unit of scheduling. So if 3 blocks are assigned to SAM and each block has 256 threads, how many warps are there in the SAM? This is an easy question, if it comes up in the exam, okay? You start with the block. You say, each block has 256. So every 32 is a warp, so each block really have 256 divided by 32, which is 8 warps. And then I have 3 blocks in the SM, so that's 3 times 8. That gives you 24 warps, okay? And so any point in time, the reality is only one of those warps will be really using the hardware, the floating point hardware execution, okay? So you know what? This is the confusing part. Sometimes people say, you can have up to 24 warps. So your floating point performance should be, 24 times 32 floating points per clock cycle, right? You should get all that performance. No, it's not. That's not the case. You actually have even less than 32. Every time one of the warps, which means 32 threads, will be actively using the hardware. But remember, there are only 8 of those SPs. Those are the real workhorses. So the 32, once they get in, they will actually do 1, 2, 3, 4 steps. So that each step will do 8 of those threads. Okay? And so that each thread eventually, each instruction across the 32 threads actually takes 4 clock cycles to go through the real execution workhorses. Okay? So that's why empirically you can say for this G80 hardware, every time I execute a floating point add or floating point multiply, I can kind of, nominally say this add is going to take 4 clock cycles. Okay? The 4 clock cycles has to do with it takes 4 clock cycles to get all the 32 threads, same instruction to go through the 8 execution units. Okay? So every time you bring a warp onto the hardware, let's say you have a floating point add, it takes 4 clock cycles, and then you can do the next instruction. Okay? And if the next instruction is ready to execute, that next instruction will be there and do the 4 clock cycles. And then the next instruction for the clock cycles. Okay? So this is also a picture that I stole from John Nichols. He has this very artistic way of looking at things. By the way, John Nichols is a graduate from Illinois. Okay, he's the chief architect of the CUDA processor G80, and he was in charge of all these designs. And he got his undergraduate degree from Illinois, and he's he still comes back and see us quite often, and he's definitely one of the alums that we're very proud of. And so the SM hardware implements zero overhead warp scheduling. What this means is that if you look at the execution timing, I think I talked about this once in the past, but it should be even more clear at this point. Every warp is going to be at a particular program counter. Okay? So every warp is at a particular instruction execution in their progress, right? So at every clock cycle, the hardware is capable of selecting one of the warps for execution without creating any gap in the use of those SPs. So even though there's all this effort in the back, okay, trying to determine which warp to go and which instruction to fetch and all that stuff, but from the SP point of view, those instructions just keep coming. Okay, every 4 clock cycles, something comes. Every 4 clock cycles, something comes. So the hardware is kept busy. Okay, there's no gap when you switch from warp 1 to warp 2 in their execution. Okay, that switching is seamless. There's no waste of time. So the way to think about this is you have all these threads. Okay. And then you would get eight of the sort of one of the warps to come in And let's say warp 8 is executing, you know, instruction 11. And let's say instruction 11 executes, and then instruction 12 is waiting for some result from the previous instruction because of memory access. Then warp, you will go back, you know, you will actually in the background, while 8 is executing, in the background it will already stage up warp 1 instruction 42. Okay? So as soon as the four clock cycles of warp 8 instruction 11 completes, the next cycle, warp 1 instruction 42 will start to execute. And that will take four more cycles, and then four more cycles, and four more cycles, right? So if you look at the execution timing, you can have a totally seemingly random, you know what, instruction sequence from all these different warps and different instructions in the warp, right? They all kind of got mingled up in the hardware. What that also means is that all the register variables, okay, all the register variables used by all the warps, all the threads in the warp, have to be all there in the real hardware, okay? Because anytime something gets to execute, it will immediately need to have the register contents. So that's why there's so many registers, okay, in each SM. There are more than 8,000 registers, okay, in the SM, primarily because you need to keep all the register variables of all the warps, okay, all the warps in the hardware, okay, so that you can do the seamless switching. So in G80, you know what, four clock cycles is needed to, you know, to dispatch the same instruction for all the all the threads in a warp. So if you know what, one global memory access is needed for every four instructions. You know, let's say when you take a look at your code, and you look at this code that you wrote and say, aha, you know, for every four floating point multiplied and add, I'm accessing an array, okay, I'm accessing an array from the global memory. So that gives me one global memory access per four floating point add or multiplication, right? Then you will need to have a minimum of 13 warps in order to fully tolerate something like a 200 cycle memory latency. And what that means is that, you know, every time, you know what, you do a load, right? Every time you do a load, it will take 200 clock cycles, right? And 200 clock cycles divided by four clock cycles per instruction is what? 50 instructions worth. So every time you do a memory access, you need to somehow get 50 instructions to execute in the meantime, okay, before that memory access will come back, that you can continue to execute your own instruction in the same thread, right? So the first thing you do is you take 200 cycles and divide by four, okay? And that gives you the number of instructions in this thing. So as soon as you issue one memory access, you need to have 50 of these things going on before you can circle back to that same thread, okay? So 50 instructions have to come from somewhere, right? And you will be able to get four of those instructions from your own thread. But then you're going to have to have the rest of the instructions from other threads. So that's why you're going to, you know, to need to have, you know what, a minimum of 13 warps. Because 13 times 4 from each thread gives you 52. Okay? So if you have 13 of those warps in the machine, in the SM, each one will have four instructions that you can execute between the floating point loads. That gives you 52 total. So conceptually, what you can think about is you can line up all these warps, okay, conceptually, right? You line up these warps, and warp one will do the memory access, okay? And then, you know what, it will actually have to wait for, you know, 50 instructions. And then warp 2 comes in and line up the access, right? Warp 3, warp 4. So then you have, you know what, hopefully the first one comes back with 4 instructions. And you will have, you know, another 4 instructions, another 4 instructions. As soon as one thing comes back, you have 4 instructions to execute. But when you line them all up, you can have 52 instructions between the first issue and the use. So if you just do a simple-minded time frame and look at how these things lined up, having 13 warps gives you a full utilization, okay, of the execution hardware netting.
So you're saying you need 13 warps, assuming every warp can only execute one instruction. What if they can execute more than one instruction? You don't really need 13.
No. But remember, you know what, it's 4 instructions per, you know, the question is, if you assume that they can execute multiple instructions, in this case, I actually assume that they can execute 4 instructions. Because, you know what, in the steady state, essentially every time you do a memory access, you're relying on every thread to execute 4 instructions, okay? And so that you can, all the 13 warps can give you the 50 instructions you need before you need to access memory again. Yes, John?
So there are actually 2 factors of 4 being thrown in there. If you want to tolerate a hypothetical 200 cycle latency, you divide that by 4 to get the number of instructions you need to run. Hypothetically, say every warp can run 4 instructions before they block, so you only need 13 warps to cover. Right.
Yes. Before once the memory is there, you execute 4 instructions. Yeah. Okay. So you know what? You should be able to change these numbers, and then you know what? Just kind of play with that in your mind. And at some point, you also need to be careful, because if you can only execute 4 instructions per global memory access, you may be saturating the memory bandwidth. So the memory latency is no longer just 200; it could go up to 300 and 400, and so on. Okay. So that's where the slippery slopes start to happen. Yes.
You actually answered it right there.
Okay. Good. So let's take a quick look at, this is the question that Wally asked a little while back. So the instructions, the control of these instructions happen within the SEM, okay? And it's an integral part of the warp scheduler. So you know, as I mentioned, you have, you know what, a small instruction cache. And the instruction cache doesn't have to be very big, because all the warps, okay, come from the same kernel, right? So all you really need to do is to make sure that your instruction cache can contain the largest kernel that you care about, right? So, but as people do more and more CUDA programming, kernels get bigger and bigger, so I can imagine that they're getting bigger and bigger instruction cache. But the fundamental point is that all the threads are executing out of the same kernel, so you don't need to store multiple kernels in that instruction cache. That makes their design a lot easier. And if in the future NVIDIA start to allow executing multiple kernels at the same time, this is one of the things that they immediately need to pay attention to. They will need to begin to store those kernels, right, in the same instruction cache, and then they need to make sure that they have enough capacity. So that's just a footnote for the computer architecture types here. So at every clock cycle, you will fetch one warp instruction from the instruction cache, okay, and then you put it into a multi-threaded instruction buffer. So this instruction buffer is really where the magic is, okay. This instruction buffer essentially gives the instruction that a warp would execute if the instruction is ready to go. So it turns out that instruction cache is quite small, but it still takes multiple clock cycles to fetch an instruction out of that cache. So having a buffer means that you can have the instruction bits ready to go as soon as the data is ready. Okay, so you line everything up. This is, again, going back to the zero cycle scheduling overhead. Okay,
a lot of things really have to happen in the background to set up the stage right. That as soon as something is ready, you know, you ship it down, okay?
And so every clock cycle, you issue one ready-to-go warp instruction. And from the any warp instruction, so then you can take that instruction from any of the slots in the buffer. So there, you can imagine there must be 24 of those warp instruction slots in the buffer, right? And each one gives you the bits that, you know, of the next instruction. And the issue selection is based on round robin and slash age of warp. So essentially, you don't want to get into a situation where one of the warps becomes a, you know, kind of a laggard, okay? You want to make sure that these warps all kind of make progress, because if you ever have a spurious synchronization and one of the warps fell badly behind everyone else, then everyone else will be waiting at that synchronization point, okay? And that is not a good way to utilize your resources. So that's why the scheduling policy is such that it will try to be fair, try to, you know, help every warp to make roughly the same progress within a block, so that, you know, these things can go, you know, quickly. And the SAN broadcasts the same instruction to 32 threads, you know, of a warp. And so essentially all the little SPs that will receive exactly the same instruction, you know, at a given cycle.
This is the squad voting is the same concept like the CDC.
It's very similar. Yeah, I didn't see the design, but, you know, just from the functionality it's extremely similar.
So all the register operands of all the instructions in the instruction buffer are scoreboarded.
You know what? For those of you who see these, you know, as sports, right? So, you know what? Scoreboard is the place where everyone, you know, get information from in the audience, right? And, you know what, even the time left for the game, you know, how many points each one, and, you know, the penalty and all that stuff, right? So this is the same thing as a sports scoreboard. All the necessary information for scheduling things in this machine are recorded in that scoreboard. What that means is that if you have 8,000 registers, and if any of those registers is being kind of is waiting for a result from the memory, from a memory, global memory access, something on that scoreboard will be telling you that this particular register is waiting. So whenever you have a new instruction, the next instruction that needs to go into execution, the instruction will tell you which registers it needs to use, right? And the instruction opcode will also tell you which function unit it needs. And all that information is used to check the scoreboard. And the scoreboard will keep track of the register status as well as the super function units. Because the super function units are fewer in size than the SPs. You probably notice that there are only two of those special super function units. So whenever you execute something like a sine or cosine, when you use underscore, underscore, sine, underscore, underscore, that go to the super function unit hardware. But there are only two of those. So what that means is that instead of taking four turns for the 32 threads to go through them, now they have to take more turns, right, for all the instructions to go through the super function units. So that gives a latency of longer than four clock cycles for those, you know, super function units. In addition, the super function units also use iterative approximation of sine and cosine, so that these two factors make those super function units longer latency. So if another instruction needs to use sine or cosine, you may see a busy signal from the super function units. So that particular warp will have to wait for the super function units to become available, right? So, you know, other threads that need to execute, multiply, or add at that point should go into the execution. Yes?
What's the order of that latency? Dozens of
cycles? 100?
Yeah, not hundreds. It was a small number of 10. Fair?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. It's...
small number.
Yes, small number of 10s.
Yeah.
Roughly that range.
Yes.
So the amount of latency which is introduced by using one of these sines or cosines,
is it still
more efficient to use these as opposed to doing this on the CPU?
Absolutely. These latencies are, incredibly small compared to the CPU latencies. Typically you can get, if you have, let's say, about 1/10 of your operation in sine and cosine, you can typically get about 5 times speed up over the CPU just by using the hardware. Okay, but I'm going to come back to the precision and accuracy issues. So you do need to be aware of some of those issues. Okay? Yes?
So in what circumstances would you use a lookup table instead of using the...
Yeah. Okay. So the question is, when would you fall back to a lookup table approach? For those of you who program these things, because some of these functions are very expensive in CPU implementation, so oftentimes people actually use this lookup table rather than calling the library function. So you prepare some frequently used values so that you can optimize the latency. In almost all the situations, at least for sine and cosine, you pretty much never want to use lookup tables, because the lookup tables means that they're coming from the global memory or constant memory. So the lookup table is very, very hard on the constant memory. So you're going to get very bad latency out of those things on this particular hardware. So I can pretty much say that you probably just want to always use the hardware implementation as long as the accuracy satisfies your needs. Okay, so the scoreboard essentially allows you to to execute all these other warps when you are waiting for the memory latency. So that's why this picture shows that let's say for thread block one, warp one, after executing the 6th instruction, the 7th instruction cannot execute until a longer memory latency expires or is satisfied. So during this whole time that warp 1 of thread block 1 is waiting, all these other things will execute, okay? So that you can fully utilize your hardware execution. So before I let you go, I want to kind of take you through some exercise so that when you take the exam, you'll be able to answer the questions, but more importantly, when you write code, you'll be able to really think through these things very quickly. So let's take your matrix multiplication. Should I use 4x4, 8x8, 16x16, or 32x32? Okay. And you have seen this slide. You have seen this slide in a simpler form. Okay. So now I'm kind of expanding the slide a little bit and make sure that you really know how to think through these things. So if you use a 4x4 block, we have 16 threads per block. And each SM can take up to 768 threads. To field all the threads, we need to have 48 blocks, right? And 48 blocks is way more than the 8 blocks that you're allowed in each SM. So you would expect low utilization because you'll end up with only 8 times 16 threads, which is 128 threads in the SM, right? That's what you're going to end up with. Worse than that, there will be 8 blocks, and each block will have only one warp, right? 16 threads warp. And you say, wait a minute. What's the warp size again? You only have 16 per block. What that means is that even the warp, the one warp that you're going to have in that block is only half full. Okay? And it's permissible. You can do this, and it will function correctly. But every time a warp gets into execution, it's going to actually just make progress on the 16 threads
And then it's still going to take up the hardware resources for the rest of the 16 threads, okay? But those things are thrown away, okay? So you're using up hardware resources, but you're not producing any useful result. So you're being doubly penalized. You're not using a lot of warps in the SM, and each SM is only half capable, okay? For 8x8, we have 64 threads per block, and since each SM can take up to 768 threads, it could take up 12 blocks, but we're limited by the 8, so we're also going to underutilize SM. But there's one new point here. There are actually 16 warps available for scheduling SM, and each warp actually will span 4 slices in the Y dimension. This is something that most of us don't think about. When you have an 8x8, 8x8 thread block, each dimension in the X dimension only has 8 threads, right? That's less than the 32 threads you want in the warp. So 4 of those will be collected into a warp, okay? So internally, when you have multiple dimensions of block structure, these multiple dimensions will be linearized just like memory array layout, and then you will have the warp partition, okay? So when you have 16x16, you fully utilize the blocks, and then each warp now have 2 of those X dimension threads, because each one is 16, 2 of them will together give you 32. Once again, if you have 32x32, we have 1,024 threads per block. Not even one can fit into the, the block can only take 512, so this is not a feasible dimension, okay? So this finishes the lecture, and so hopefully you'll have a lot stronger understanding of these threads when we start to argue about warps in the future. But if you have any question, come back. This is where I want some help from people who are not computer architecture types. If you feel that there are certain things I can do to help you to understand these things better or quicker, let me know, so that I can incorporate some of these things into the textbook. Okay? Thank you.